synaptosis and synaptic plasticity in the cerebellum.
So I want to start thanking Takao for putting this together. It's my first time at an IMFAR meeting, and I've really learned a tremendous amount. And one minor comment, there's a lot of fantastic neuroscience at the Friedrich Miescher Institute in Basel, but I'm actually at the university, at the Biozentrum. And what you see here is the view out of my office. Not quite. So we've heard at the meeting quite a lot about the genetic risk factors for autism, and in particular this morning about rare but very high impact mutations. And I think you can essentially group these into two general classes. One are mutations that seem to be fairly specific for autism, and then larger mutational deletions that often are associated with syndromic forms of autism that are rather multifaceted diseases and where a substantial fraction of the patients meet the criteria for autism. And thus, these have been really good monogenic models for the disease. And the questions that I want to address in this talk today is really one on really what are fundamental functional consequences of the gene alterations that you get, at least for some of these high-impact mutations, and then really the key questions, how similar are syndromic and non-syndromic forms, and are there certain convergence points between different genetic lesions that emerge, and this is really important if you think about, and we heard this, I think, from Dan's talk this morning very clearly about how there's this enormous number of mutations now, and the hope is that these could be consolidated in a smaller number of core processes or core pathways that then also for therapeutic approaches could be targeted in a more concerted fashion. And then the second key question is really how reversible is all of this? This is a neurodevelopmental disorder, at least it's been discussed like that. The question is, if circuits develop in an abnormal way, can you actually restore their function? This slide here is my attempt of consolidating some of these rare mutations into common pathways, and you see essentially three domains. One is directly at the synapse, so this would be a glutamatergic and a GABAergic synapse here. And you see the gene names marked in red that have been found in CNV studies and association studies, including both bridges across the synapse, adhesion molecules, scaffolding molecules that regulate these adhesion complexes, and then signaling compounds, in particular in the mTOR pathway that converges onto translational regulation, and then mutations in genes that regulate alternative splicing, chromatin remodeling, and also transcription. And here they're all drawn together like they really do act in a pathway, but I think it's fair to say that from loss-of-function experiments, we have actually very little evidence how many of these connections are really there and how many of these are relevant for the disease. What we've done in our study is really focused just on one single one of these rare mutations, and this is a mutation in neuroligand 3. In patients, this has been found by Thomas Bergeron's lab as a point mutation, but then there are also more recent studies that found copy number variations in neuroligand 3, and I should point out these copy number variations are deletions that remove almost the entire coding sequence of the gene. So it's, I think, fair to assume that this is a complete loss of function. Neuroligand 3 is an adhesion molecule, it's in the postsynaptic membrane and forms a complex with norexin that we've already heard quite a bit in this meeting already. This complex is thought to organize synaptic junctions and also give them certain functional properties. Both, actually, the point mutation as a knock-in and the complete deletion have already been modeled in mice. This is work from Tom Sudov's lab, Ned Heinz's lab, and also Niels Brose's lab. And phenotypes have been described in the behavioral level that are in the autism domain. So there are deficits in social interaction in the point mutant, but enhanced spatial memory. And then in the knockout, so the full knockout, defects in social memory, reduced ultrasonic vocalization, but also an impairment olfactory function, hyperactivity. So we actually generated a new neuroligand 3 knockout started out first looking whether we can recapitulate, reproduce these findings that were described by Niels Brose and Hannelore Ehrenreich, and you see here just part of this data on the hyperactivity from the Ehrenreich lab. We actually see the same in our knockout model. And here this memory index for social interaction, so this is a measure of social memory, how mice discriminate novel and previously known mice that they're interacting with. And we also see a very similar defect in our model. So we think this is actually a fairly robust phenotype, as we can reproduce this in a different model and in a completely different place. Now, the reason that we actually went out to make a new model was that we engineered the locus in a way that it's a reversible knockout allele. So this essentially targets a stop cassette into the neoligand 3 locus and also tetracycline operator sequences. And this now allows to actually, it leads to complete inactivation. You see this here, that the protein is completely lost, but it allows to turn back on expression either in doxycycline control by TTA driven in specific subsets of cells or also by Cre recombinase excising the stop cassette from the locus. And this is a model that was developed largely in René Hen's lab at Columbia University, and we collaborated with them on that. We used the cerebellum as a model system to then look for phenotypes and look for readouts because, on one hand, you've heard quite a lot about how the cerebellum might be involved in autism, but then there's also a purely opportunistic reason, and that is it's actually very simple, it's very organized, and so we have extremely sensitive ways of reading out phenotypes. And this is a oversimplified version of cerebellar circuitry with the parallel fibers coming from the granule cells, and you can see if you stain for endogenous neoligand 3, the protein is actually found here at these parallel fiber synapses. This is up here in the molecular layer, and it's also found in the IGL of the synapses between MOSI fibers and granule cells. This image here also shows you this reversible knockout, so here you have the staining in the molecular layer in the IGL, and when you look at a Purkinje cell-specific re-expression, so this is this construct here where we have TTA-driven re-expression only in Purkinje cells, you still you abolish all of this staining down here, but you get increased staining up in the molecular layer. So the system really works very nicely and it's very specific. When we look at high magnification, we can confirm that the protein is really, the endogenous protein is only at the parallel fiber synapses. You see this nice opposition here between VGLUT1 and a neoligand 3. I should point out we do not see any protein at the inhibitory synapses onto the Purkinje cells or at the climbing fiber synapses. So this was really our starting point, right? Finding the protein at this specific population of synapses and then asking, are those synapses actually changed structurally or functionally? And initially we looked at a number of proteins that are found in the synapses in the protein level. They're not changed. We looked by EM. We don't see strong ultrastructural changes here. We looked by physiology. Paired pulse ratio is fairly normal. And there's a very small decrease in the mini amplitude that we can pick up here. So this means sort of the basal function of those synapses does not seem to be majorly affected. However, this decrease in amplitude made us think about mechanisms that regulate AMPA receptors at these synapses. And Takao already pointed out in the introduction, the parallel fiber synapse was actually a place where a form of LTD, an mGluR-dependent form of LTD, was first described. And this is a mechanism that is dependent on metabotropic glutamate receptor 1. So this is a group 1 receptor, but a different from the mGluR5 that's mostly started in cortex. Then through a signaling cascade leading to phosphorylation of the AMPA receptors, which then dissociate from the synaptic scaffold, get endocytosed and degraded. And given that we picked up a small decrease in the mini amplitude, we ask whether now actually this process of mGluR-LTD would be altered. What we found is that it's really completely absent, so we cannot induce mGluR-LTD in the neoligand 3 knockout mice anymore. So this is the baseline. Wild type gives nice depression by application of the mGluR1 agonist DHPG, whereas in the knockout we cannot induce any long-term depression anymore. We think this is actually an occlusion of LTD, and that we can conclude by looking at the signaling pathway, particularly this phosphorylation event here of the AMPA receptor subunit. And when we look at steady state, so without any stimulus, we see that the phosphorylated amount of the GluA2 subunit is strongly increased in the neoligand 3 knockout. And then contrary, when we stimulate in wild type, phosphorylation goes up, so this is normalized to non-stimulated, so at base level it's at 1, and then it would go up in the wild type. The phosphorylation in the neoligand 3 knockout actually goes down, and we think this is because the pre-phosphorylated receptors get degraded in this knockout. So this means we have a physiological defect at the synapses and the plasticity, and the question now would be, why would we have an occlusion? What could be the mechanism of this? And so we looked at the components that are critical for the LTD induction, the mGlu1 itself, the GlutA2 levels, and also at GlutD2, another receptor at the synapses that's been implicated to be required for normal LTD at the synapses. And it turns out that GlutD2 and GlutA2 are not significantly changed. So this is total protein level from the cerebellum normalized to wild type. So wild type would be at 1. These stay really around the same level, but there's a massive increase in mGlu1 expression in the neurligand 3 knockout. So this would argue there's really gain of function in this pathway. And we can further confirm this by looking by immunostaining at the mGlu1 level in the spines of the Purkinje cells. You see this here in green, the labeling in the spine heads, and then through three-dimensional quantitative line scans, we can quantify this, and you see again there's a strong increase of the mGlu1 alpha form in there. So this is total protein level, but also in the synapses it's increased. Now, this could be a rather general network effect, or it could be cell autonomous, and we can actually test that again with this re-expression system, so we can put back neuroligand 3 only in the Purkinje cells throughout the development, and then you can see that normalizes the mGlu1 levels, both measured in the protein level as well as in the spine heads measured by morphology. So this means we find this autism risk gene product, neuroligand 3, in the Purkinje cells only at one class of synapses, at these parallel fiber synapses. The synapses form normally, but they have a defect in their plasticity. And then the next question we wanted to ask is whether that has broader effects on the cerebellar circuitry. In particular, we looked at the climbing fibers, because it's well known that here's a form of heterosynaptic competition between parallel fibers and climbing fibers that then delineates a territory on the dendritic tree of the Purkinje cell that has only climbing fibers, and there's a territory, that has climbing fibers and a territory where climbing fibers do not invade and where there is only parallel fiber synapses on the dendritic tree. We can look at this, again, because in the cerebellum we have such nice markers, and you see here VGLUT2 staining, so this is the vesicular glutamate transporter that's specifically in the climbing fiber terminals. This is a section along the vermis of the cerebellum. The Purkinje cell bodies lie here, and you see here the punctate structures crawling along the dendritic tree, so these are the climbing fibers, and you see in this upper fifth of the molecular layer, there's only very few synapses in wild type, and there's a very strong increase in the neuroligand 3 knockout. So there are ectopic synapses formed in the neuroligand 3 knockout. And just to reiterate that, neuroligand 3 is not localized to climbing fiber synapses, so we think this is really a heterosynaptic competition event. We can also pick this up by electrophysiology, so when we measure evoked transmission from the climbing fibers into the Purkinje cell, transmission is increased. And again, if we put back neuroligand 3 only into the Purkinje cell, then we can prevent the formation of these ectopic synapses in the distal part of the molecular layer. Now, this brings me to the last point that I brought up before. How reversible are these phenotypes? So we have a phenotype that evolves during development. It's based on a heterosynaptic competition, and it has this elevation of mGlu1. And the question is, if once you form these kind of ectopic synapses, once you have afferents growing into a part of the cerebellum where they're actually not supposed to be, can you even reverse this in the adult? And we can test that with our reversible knockout model. So we treat the mice, we put a TTA only into the Purkinje cells, raise the mice in presence of doxycycline that inactivates the transactivator. This means our neuroligand 3 is a knockout model. We wait until 30 days postnatally and then remove the doxycycline from the drinking water and give 30 days for expression. So this would ask if in these adolescent animals, when development is pretty much completed in the cerebellum at P21, whether we can reverse the phenotype. And as you can see here, we actually can completely bring back the mGlu1 level down to the wild-type level, and we can also remove all of these ectopic synapses that are forming in the distal part of the molecular layer. So there's a remarkable plasticity in the system, even, I guess I shouldn't call it adult, but in adolescent animals. To summarize the first part of the talk, we find that the neuroligand 3 gene product is associated with a specific subset of synapses in the cerebellum. Loss of the neuroligand 3 gives us this increase in mGlu1, and we think consequently, though we've not formally shown this, reduced glutamatergic transmission in the disrupted parallel fiber climbing fiber competition, occlusion of LTD, and the formation of ectopic synapses that can be rescued after completion of development. And now what was really striking to us, and this is coming back to this point of convergence of pathways, is that we came upon a pathway that's been extremely well studied in the context of syndromic models of autism spectrum disorders, in particular Fragile X. Here you have normal levels of the group 1 mGluRs, mostly mGlu5 has been looked at, and then through the loss of FRMRP, unrestrained translation, which then gives an increase in mGluR-dependent LTD, and this is thought to be important for a substantial amount of the phenotype in these mice. Now, in the neuroligand 3 knockouts, we have the same pathway presumably operating, but here we have a gain of function of the receptor, and this would not only be predicted to elevate translation, but also drive this initial step of AMPA receptor endocytosis, and we think that thus we might get this occlusion of mGluR-LTD. Now, this analogy really then motivated us to look in more detail whether indeed we actually see changes in translation in the neuroligand 3 knockouts to really get further support for this idea that there's a convergence of pathways. And one way to look at this, I mean, this has been worked out extremely well by a number of labs in the context of Fragile X. There is the ERK pathway and the mTOR pathway that both converge onto the translation initiation, also the ribosome, the processivity of the ribosomes during translation, and the L6K as a mediator of mTOR-dependent signals, and then also EIF4E that's also regulated through these pathways. And when we use phosphoantibodies against EIF4E and L6K as readouts for changes in this pathway, and this is done in slices that we stimulate, cerebellar slices that we stimulate with DHPG, either from wild type or from knockout animals, we can reproduce what's been well described in the literature, that with DHPG, so mGluR stimulation, you get an increase in EIF4E phosphorylation, an increase in L6K phosphorylation, but you do not see that at all in the neuroligand 3 knockouts. So we think there's actually a deregulation of this downstream pathway, similar to what's been associated with Fragile X. Then we look directly at translation, and we use the SUNSET method that's been published recently, measuring puromycin incorporation, again in slice, stimulating with DHPG, and you see that in wild type, you get time-dependent 2 minutes, 5 minutes, 10 minutes, you get an increase of translation here, and the baseline translation, or the early translation neuroligand 3 knockouts is elevated, and then it actually peaks earlier and then plateaus off. So we think that's pretty direct evidence that there's indeed a translation change in this neuroligand 3 model. And again, I want to reiterate, this is really a synaptic adhesion molecule where we didn't expect at all that this would be impacting these types of translation pathways. And so this, of course, then also gives us ideas about intervention, and there's a number of drugs that target the ERK pathway and also the TOR pathway, and we're just starting this in behavioral experiments, but I want to share with you one piece of data from this. This is an olfactory habituation paradigm that Jackie Crawley's lab has pioneered, where you measure the time that mice are exploring either non-social odors like almond or banana, or then social odors. And you can see when you present a mouse with these different stimuli, they give a strong response to social odors. And then the open circles here are the wild types. That then if you present the same odor again and again, they lose interest in it. And then if you come with a different social odor, they have increased interest to this again. If we do this assay with the neuroligand 3 knockouts, they actually initially respond the same, but as if they cannot discriminate or they cannot know what is a novel social odor or and whatnot, they do not really respond to the second odor anymore. And we now treated adult animals with an inhibitor of translation out of the MAP kinase pathway, and you can see you actually completely reverse this the social memory index phenotype in the neuroligand 3 knockout. So we think that's a very early and initial sign that really this translational pathway is a very good target, not just in Fragile X, but also in these non-syndromic forms of autism. And just for reference, we also looked at the hyperactivity. This is actually not rescued by the translation inhibitor that we used. We think that's actually interesting, or we're actually happy about this, because we know we can actually conclude that this social phenotype that we see is not a secondary consequence of hyperactivity, but they're really separatable processes. So then, to summarize, we started out with one single of these rare mutations, and just through a detailed analysis of the pathways, found that there's essentially two entry points for therapeutic intervention. One would be downstream here on this translation machinery, and the other is maybe less novel in a sense, because group 1 antagonists have been quite widely used, though we actually think that mGlu1 might have been neglected in thinking about these antagonists, because in certain brain areas mGlu1 actually has a profound function. And this is, to put this into context, this is an image taken from Kim Huber's lab and Christian Lüscher on mGlu1 and mGlu5, shown in green and in blue, where their regional expression is. So all of the work in Fragile X really has been focused on mGlu5, in part because that's the primary form in hippocampus and cortex. But as we now think or know, that the cerebellum, for example, and also the thalamus, and certainly the VTA as a reward center, is extremely important in questions of autism. So I think these regions that are high in mGlu1, and in my view, actually would put up the priority to actually not and only focus on mGlu5, but also think about mGlu1 antagonists for treating for their potential to treat autism spectrum disorders. And this brings me to the end. I want to highlight in particular this gentleman here, Stéphane Baudouin. He's the postdoc who's really driven this entire project and done a spectacular job. And he needs a new job. So if someone wants a really wonderful colleague, call him. And then I want to thank Kasper Vogt, who helped us a lot with the LTD measurements. And this was a very important collaboration with René Hen on generating the reversible knockout model. Chris DeZeo helped us with establishing the Erasmus ladder. And we were generously supported by a European network, EU Ames, and also by Roche, and collaborating with Will Spohr in there. And thanks for your attention. So the question is whether we tried metafenidate to rescue the hyperactivity. We haven't done that yet. So I don't know. Our main focus is actually really on this translational regulators now. And the question there for me is whether if we treat earlier, now we did adult treatment, right, after development was completed, if we treat early, if that would actually affect it, or whether these are actually separable pathways.
Peter, the very nice presentation. In the animals, when you knock out early, is there any change in neurogenesis itself, in proliferation, lobule formation?
So morphologically, the cerebellum is really completely normal. We have not seen major, at least not completely normal is a very strong statement. We have not seen any major changes in volume. We're looking at this by MRI as well now. To quantify it, and then we're looking at the rat model now to look at it in more detail, where the imaging will be a bit easier. But we do not see major changes in volume.
Is this translational inhibitor that you're using, is that targeted in any way, or is this sort of a generalized inhibitor of translation? Are you dealing with miRNAs, or what are you dealing with?
It's in the MAP kinase pathway. It would be predicted to block cap-dependent translation or reduce that. And so the exact complement of mRNAs that are affected by it, we do not know yet. And whether all we've done the translation profiling on this, and it's certainly going down, but we do not know yet whether this is very specific to certain proteins, or whether it's a global dampening of all translation there.
That was a question, really. Thank you.
I was also wondering, are there any changes in the interneuron populations, the GABA neurons, by manipulating neuroligan?
Yeah, so we have not seen that. So we've looked only superficially at the GABAergic transmission onto the Purkinje cell, and there seem to be changes. You're probably aware of this paper that Tom Sydow's lab and Malenka's lab just published in Neuron that showed changes in endocannabinoid signaling in the neuroligin 3 knockout. I think it's quite conceivable that that also happens, that this could be responsible for the changes in GABA transmission we see. In terms of cell specification, we have not looked very detailed, but we've scored the density of GABA neurons, and we can, by position, distinguish the basket and stellate cells. We do not see a big difference. So I think it would be at the functional level. Maybe just as a note on the endocannabinoid link, there is, of course, a clear connection between mGluRs and endocannabinoid signaling for 2AG, and so we think these might actually be connected to each other.
Okay, thank you again, Peter.